We all want to understand the big picture, right? Like, how does something as massive, as complex as the global economy actually work? You know, beyond just the daily headlines.
Absolutely.
What does economic growth truly mean for, say, your job, your wallet, or even the planet?
Yeah.
And I mean, is it even possible for growth to benefit everyone and be sustainable? That's a huge question.
It really is.
That's precisely what we're diving into today. Our focus is economic growth and sustainability.
Okay.
We're going to try and cut through some of the noise, get to the most important nuggets of knowledge from the material we've gathered.
Sounds good.
Hopefully, you'll walk away with a clearer understanding of economic growth dynamics, everything from, basic definitions to the critical concepts of inclusive and sustainable development.
It's true. While economic growth often sounds abstract, maybe like something confined to financial reports,
Right.
its rhythm truly beats through every aspect of our lives. So today we're going to pull back the curtain a bit, explore what growth signifies, how it undulates, through various cycles, and perhaps most crucially, how we can ensure it's not just about bigger numbers, but about genuine well-being for all, without mortgaging the future.
Okay, so if we dive into growth itself, economists often look at it through two crucial lenses, right? What's happening right now and what's truly possible.
Exactly.
This brings us to actual growth versus potential growth in a nation's output.
Yeah.
Actual growth is, well, it's what you see day to day. It's the percentage increase in a country's real gross domestic product, GDP, over a specific period.
Right, it's current speed.
Think of it as the economy's current speed on the highway. It tells you exactly how much more stuff, more services are being produced using the resources currently employed. And this real-time performance is heavily influenced by changes in aggregate demand.
Which is just the total spending.
Right. Total spending by consumers, businesses, government, across the whole economy.
Exactly. But then there's potential growth. This isn't about what the economy is doing, but what it could do. It's maximum sustainable speed, if you like.
Ah, the speed limit.
Sort of, yeah. The maximum speed the economy could reach if all its resources, every available worker, all the capital equipment, land, entrepreneurship were fully and importantly, efficiently utilized.
Okay.
It represents the economy's ultimate productive capacity, pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
And what drives that?
Well, this kind of growth is driven by changes in aggregate supply.
Okay, supply side.
That's the total amount of goods and services firms are willing and able to produce at a given price level. So we're talking long-term improvement,
As such.
like better productivity, new technologies, maybe a larger, more skilled workforce, things that boost the fundamental capacity.
So, just to quickly summarize the tension here, actual growth is about what's actually produced now, driven by spending.
Aggregate demand.
Potential growth is about what could be produced if everything was optimized, driven by improvements in how we make things.
Aggregate supply.
Why does this distinction matter for you, the listener, beyond just a textbook definition?
Wow.
Because if a country is only experiencing actual growth without increasing its potential, it's like a sprinter pushing harder in a race, but they haven't actually built more muscle.
Good analogy.
They might run faster for a bit, yeah, but they'll hit a wall. Or worse, burn out.
Exactly. True long-term economic health hinges on expanding that potential. You need to build the muscle, not just sprint harder.
Okay.
And what's truly fascinating is how these two types of growth, while they rarely move in perfect sync, they often create a gap in the economy.
An output gap.
Precisely, an output gap. A negative output gap happens when actual GDP is below potential GDP.
So we're running slower than the speed limit.
Exactly. Imagine the economy has that maximum speed limit's potential. A negative output gap means overall spending, aggregate demand, just isn't strong enough to even get close.
What does that look like?
Businesses aren't selling enough, so they produce less. You
Yeah.
get underutilized factories, high unemployment.
Right.
You might see low inflation, maybe even deflation, because there's simply too much supply chasing, too little demand. This is very common during recessions.
Okay. And then the other side of the coin.
The positive output gap. That's when actual GDP manages to exceed potential GDP, at least temporarily.
Pushing past the speed limit, redlining.
That's a good way to put it. The economy is redlining, running beyond its sustainable capacity. Resources become overworked.
Like factories running 24/7.
Exactly. Factories running round-the-clock shifts with maybe not enough maintenance, or job markets so tight that every available person is employed, and maybe more.
Sounds unsustainable.
It is. This could lead to significant inflationary pressure, Too much money chasing too few goods, prices rise, and sometimes even trade deficits as the nation imports more just to keep up with that intense demand. We often see this during, you know, overheated economic booms.
And what are the consequences if these gaps stick around?
They can be quite profound. Prolonged negative gaps, deep recessions, can lead to something economists call hysteresis.
Hysteresis. Sounds complicated.
It's a bit of a fancy word, but the idea is very real. It means a prolonged slump can cause the economy to sort of forget how to be productive.
How?
Well, think of skilled factory workers who are unemployed for so long they retrain for other fields, maybe lower skilled ones, or crucial equipment sits idle and rusts away.
So even when demand eventually picks up,
that lost capacity, those lost skills might be gone forever. It fundamentally shrinks the economic pie for good.
Wow. Okay. And the positive gaps, if they persist.
Persistent positive gaps can lead to that overheated economy, unsustainable inflation, and often end up popping some kind of bubble. Think housing bubbles, stock market crashes.
Right.
So this raises an important question, doesn't it? How might these gaps subtly influence your daily life?
Yeah.
From, say, job opportunities when the economy is sluggish.
Fewer jobs, lower wages maybe.
To that creeping increase in prices for your groceries when it's running too hot.
Yeah, inflation eating away at your budget.
Exactly.
And all of this, of course, plays out on the grand stage of the business cycle, that natural ebb and flow of economic activity.
The roller coaster.
The roller coaster, yes. Mm. Hopefully not always quite as stomach churning. There are four main phases, typically. First, expansion or a boom.
Things are looking up.
Right. GDP is rising, unemployment falls, consumer confidence, investment are generally high. Businesses are hiring, people feel good. Mm. Next, we hit the peak, the top of that roller coaster. The economy reaches its maximum output. Resources are fully employed.
And inflation might start to become a worry.
Exactly. Then comes the descent. Contraction or recession.
The downturn.
GDP begins to fall. Unemployment starts to rise. And both consumer spending and business investment decline. Things feel less certain.
Yeah.
Finally, we reach the trough or slump, the lowest point of economic activity. Things can feel pretty bleak here.
The bottom of the cycle.
But the cycle continues, and typically a recovery follows, leading back eventually to expansion.
So what causes these cycles, these ups and downs?
Well, it can be a mix of things. Sometimes it's demand-side shocks.
Like what?
Like a sudden drop in consumer confidence. Maybe people get worried about the future and stop spending. Or a major shift in government spending, or even global trade dynamics, like a fall in exports.
Okay.
Other times, it's supply side shocks.
Ah, affecting production itself.
Right. Like a sudden jump in oil prices that makes everything more expensive to produce and transport. Or natural disasters hitting key industries.
Sure.
And let's not forget speculative bubbles. We mentioned those. Housing bubbles, stock market booms that inflate unsustainably and then pop.
Sending ripples everywhere.
Exactly. Even changes in central bank monetary policy, like raising or lowering interest rates, can significantly influence the ride.
But thankfully, we're not just passengers completely at the mercy of these economic waves, are we? The economy has some built-in shock absorbers.
Ah, the automatic stabilizers.
Yes. Automatic stabilizers. These are really clever mechanisms that help smooth out economic volatility without needing any active new government intervention. They just work automatically.
How so? Give us an example.
Okay, well, think about progressive taxes.
Where higher earners pay a higher percentage.
Exactly. So when the economy is booming, people earn more, they move into higher tax brackets, and government tax revenues naturally increase.
Which takes some spending power out of the economy.
Precisely. It acts as a mild brake on the boom, preventing it from getting too overheated.
And the reverse in a recession.
Right. In a recession, incomes fall. People drop into lower tax brackets, maybe pay no income tax at all. That automatically provides some financial relief, leaving more money in their pockets than otherwise.
Okay, that makes sense. What's another one?
Another powerful stabilizer is welfare payments. Things like unemployment benefits, food assistance, other social safety nets.
How do they stabilize?
During economic downturns, obviously more people become unemployed, their incomes drop, so more people become eligible for these benefits.
Right.
This provides a critical floor for aggregate demand. It stops spending from completely collapsing because people still have some income support. It helps soften the economic slide.
And in an upturn.
Fewer people need the benefits as they find jobs, so those payments naturally decrease. The support scales back automatically.
So when you look at the whole picture, these automatic stabilizers are, well, they're kind of the unsung heroes.
I think that's a great way to put it. They don't prevent recessions or booms entirely, of course.
No.
But they significantly prevent those swings from being even more dramatic. They help smooth out the peaks and troughs without anyone having to rush and pass a new law every time. It's like the economy has its own sort of self-correcting mechanisms built in.
Okay. So given these natural cycles and automatic stabilizers, what are the deliberate actions governments and central banks take? Trying and guide the economy to really fuel growth.
Ah, now we're talking about active policy.
Right. This brings us to various economic policies. First, let's talk supply-side policies.
Okay, focus on the potential.
Exactly. These are all about improving the economy's productive capacity in the long run, boosting that potential growth we talked about.
So what kind of things?
Think about investing in education and training, making the workforce more skilled, more adaptable. Offering tax incentives for companies to invest in research and development, R&D.
Fostering innovation.
Yes. Cutting red tape through deregulation, making it easier to start and grow businesses. Or building better infrastructure, roads, ports, high-speed internet.
Things that make the whole economy more efficient.
Right. Now, their effectiveness is generally seen as high in the long run, but they often take years, sometimes even decades, to show their full results. And they usually require significant, sustained government investment. It's not a quick fix.
Definitely a long game.
Then there are demand-side policies. These are more about short-run stimulation, particularly useful when the economy is in a slump, in that negative output gap.
Managing the cycle.
Exactly. This includes fiscal policy. That's the government's toolkit, spending, and taxation. They can increase government spending directly, maybe on infrastructure projects, or they can cut taxes to put more money directly into people's pockets. Both are aimed at boosting overall demand.
Getting people spending again.
And then there's monetary policy. This is the central bank's job.
The Fed, the Bank of England, ECB.
Exactly. They adjust interest rates, making borrowing cheaper to encourage spending and investment, or more expensive to cool things down. They also control the money supply.
Powerful tools for the short to medium term.
Definitely. And finally, we can't forget the role of trade and investment.
Opening up to the world.
Yeah, liberalizing trade policies, making it easier to import and export, attracting foreign direct investment, FDI, bringing in capital and expertise from abroad. Promoting exports can all significantly boost growth.
New markets, new ideas.
And encouraging innovation and competition through various means also helps raise that long-term potential output, pushing businesses to be more efficient, more creative.
So, a whole range of policy levers governments can pull.
Indeed. But how well do they actually work, the evaluation piece?
Yes. This is where the complexity truly lies. Their success isn't guaranteed at all.
Why not?
Well, it depends on a really intricate mix of factors. First, the specific blend of policies chosen. You can't just use one hammer for every economic nail, right?
Right.
Needs a mix. Then there's the time lag.
Yeah.
How long does it take for a policy decision, like an interest rate cut or a tax change, to actually filter through the economy and have an effect?
Wow.
It's often longer than people think.
Oh, okay.
And, crucially, the institutional capacity of the government.
Meaning?
Meaning, can the government actually implement these policies effectively? It's one thing for policymakers to, you know, dream up a brilliant new education strategy.
Yeah, huh?
It's quite another to get it rolled out effectively across every single school district in a country.
Yeah.
Implementation matters.
A lot.
A lot.
True.
And you also have to consider the broader global economic conditions. A country doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Right. Global recessions, trade wars.
Exactly. What's fascinating here, I think, is how policymakers have to be almost like master chefs.
Huh. How so?
They have to blend different ingredients, fiscal policy, monetary policy, trade, supply-side reforms, in just the right amounts at the right time to try and get the right economic dish.
I like that analogy.
And that coordination, especially between fiscal policy, government spending taxing, and monetary policy, central bank actions, is absolutely essential. You can't have them pulling in completely different directions. That just leads to confusion or cancels each other out.
Okay. So we've talked about growth numbers, cycles, policies, but beyond just the cold numbers of GDP growth, there's a deeper idea, isn't there, about how economies should function.
Yeah, moving beyond just more to better.
Exactly. And that's inclusive economic growth.
A really important concept.
It's not enough for the economic pie to simply get bigger anymore, is it? The goal here is broad-based, sustainable growth that truly allows all members of society to contribute to, and importantly, benefit from, economic progress.
Sharing the prosperity.
Yes. It's about ensuring equitable opportunity, reducing poverty, and seeing tangible improvements in the overall quality of life for everyone, not just a select few at the top.
Exactly. The impact on equity and equality here is, or at least should be, truly transformative.
How so?
Well, inclusive growth promotes a stronger social fabric, greater political stability. Because when people feel they're part of the system, that they have a stake and are benefiting,
society is more stable, less tension.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It actively works to reduce income and wealth inequality, which, as we know, is a massive challenge in many, many nations today.
Huge.
Plus, it enhances human capital development. That means people are healthier, better educated, more skilled.
Which feeds back into potential growth, too.
Precisely. And it improves access to essential services, clean water, sanitation, electricity, healthcare for those who might have historically been marginalized or left behind.
So it sounds great in theory. How do we actually make that happen? What policies can truly promote inclusive growth?
Well, there's a range of deliberate approaches governments can take. Redistribution policies are key.
Like taxes and benefits.
Yes. Progressive taxation, where higher earners contribute a larger percentage of their income in taxes. That revenue can then fund increased welfare spending to support vulnerable populations. Pensions, disability benefits, child support.
Okay.
Then there's significant investment in human capital. This isn't just about building schools, remember. It's about ensuring accessible, high-quality education from early childhood right through adult learning.
Lifelong learning.
Yes. And comprehensive health care for everyone. Plus, skill development programs that actually meet the demands of a changing economy, making sure people have the skills for the jobs of today and tomorrow.
What else?
We also need strong labor market policies.
Like minimum wage.
That's part of it. Establishing minimum wage laws that ensure a living wage, potentially offering employment guarantees in certain sectors or for certain groups, and robust anti-discrimination legislation to ensure fair opportunities for everyone, regardless of gender, race, background. And crucially, financial inclusion.
Making sure everyone can access banking.
Essentially, yes. Making sure everyone, even those in remote rural areas or with very low incomes, has access to basic credit, savings accounts, insurance, and other banking services. This empowers them to save, invest, manage risks, and build their lives.
Right. So how well do these policies work, the evaluation?
Well, the long-term benefits seem clear. Reducing inequality, improving overall productivity through better human capital, creating more stable societies.
Mm-hmm.
But implementing them isn't easy. They often face big challenges. Fiscal constraints are a major one. How do you actually pay for all this investment in education, health, and social safety nets?
Yeah, the funding question.
And complex governance issues.
Hey.
Making sure these policies are actually effective on the ground, that the money isn't wasted, that they reach the people they're intended to help. That requires good institutions, low corruption.
Big hurdles.
Definitely. This raises a really important question. How do we design policies that truly ensure nobody is left behind as the economy grows? And maybe more importantly, can we overcome the political and economic hurdles to actually make that happen consistently?
A critical question indeed. And that leads us, finally, to what is arguably the most crucial aspect for our collective future. Sustainable economic growth.
Absolutely vital.
This definition isn't just about today or even the next few years. It's about ensuring that our current economic development doesn't compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs.
Intergenerational equity.
Exactly. It's a delicate, essential balancing act, making sure we weigh economic objectives, environmental protection, and social well-being equally in pretty much every decision we make.
It's a fundamental shift in thinking.
It has to be. And this concept is deeply tied to how we approach using and conserving resources.
Doing more with less.
Yes. It demands a sharp focus on resource efficiency and aggressively embracing renewable energy sources, solar, wind, geothermal, instead of continuing to deplete finite fossil fuels. It also encourages sustainable land use, thoughtful water conservation, and a massive reduction in waste. The whole idea of a circular economy is central here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Keeping materials in use for as long as possible, minimizing waste, designing products for durability and repairability, moving away from the linear take, make, dispose model.
So if we connect this to the long-term impacts, it's really about realizing our economic actions today have profound, lasting consequences for tomorrow's world.
Indeed. Economic growth, if it's not managed sustainably, can unfortunately, and often does, increase greenhouse gas emissions. It contributes to widespread pollution, air, water, soil. It accelerates biodiversity loss.
The impact on environment and climate change.
It's severe. Unsustainable growth directly leads to environmental degradation and climate change, which, ironically, then reduces future economic potential. By damaging human health through pollution, disrupting critical sectors like agriculture and fisheries, through changing weather patterns and ocean acidification, and destroying essential infrastructure, through more frequent and intense extreme weather events, floods, droughts, storms.
A vicious cycle.
It can be.
So how do we break it? What policies can mitigate this environmental impact while still allowing for development?
There's a whole suite of policies being discussed and implemented, often quite controversially. Green taxes are one approach.
Like carbon taxes.
Carbon taxes, yes. Or taxes on plastic packaging, fines for pollution. The idea is to make environmentally damaging activities more expensive, internalize those external costs, and thus discourage them.
Okay. What else?
Cap and trade systems. These create a market-based incentive. A cap is set on total emissions, permits are issued or auctioned, and firms can then buy or sell these permits.
Well, so firms that can cut pollution cheaply sell permits to those where it's more expensive.
Exactly. It limits overall pollution while allowing flexibility and encouraging innovation in emissions reduction.
Makes sense.
Governments can also provide subsidies and grants for positive actions, things like installing solar panels, improving home energy efficiency, adopting sustainable farming practices, actively encouraging the green transition.
Carrots as well as sticks.
Precisely. And then there are robust environmental regulations, setting clear legal limits on emissions, protecting natural areas like forests and wetlands, implementing zoning laws to prevent harmful development in sensitive areas.
Setting the rules of the game.
Yes. And finally, significant public investment is often needed. In green infrastructure like smart grids and electric vehicle charging networks, in vastly improved public transport systems, in modern waste management and recycling facilities, providing the backbone for a sustainable economy.
So the evaluation. Do these work? What are the challenges?
Well, these policies can work, but they must be designed very carefully. You have to avoid unintended negative side effects, like potentially harming employment in carbon-intensive industries if the transition isn't managed well, or reducing the competitiveness of domestic firms if other countries don't adopt similar policies.
Like a carbon leakage problem.
Right.
It needs careful design.
Very careful. And critically, international cooperation is absolutely essential here. Climate change, pollution, biodiversity loss. These are global problems. They don't respect national borders. So you need coordinated international action.
Disarming.
Understatement of the year, perhaps, but vital nonetheless.
Wow. What a journey we've been on. We've really covered a lot of ground today.
We certainly have.
We started with the fundamentals, didn't we? Understanding that crucial difference between actual growth and potential growth and how those output gaps can really impact an economy.
The basics.
Then we rode that roller coaster of the business cycle, seeing how economies naturally fluctuate and how those unsung heroes, the automatic stabilizers, help smooth things out a bit.
Right.
We then moved on to the deliberate policies governments and central banks use to try and fuel growth, supply side, demand side, trade strategies. The policy toolkit.
The chef's ingredients.
Ah, yes. And we wrapped up with two truly critical frameworks for thinking about growth today. Inclusive growth.
Ensuring prosperity benefits everyone.
And sustainable growth.
Making sure our development doesn't compromise the future.
You, our listener, now hopefully have a fantastic shortcut to being much more well-informed on these complex but utterly vital topics.
Absolutely. And maybe just one final thought to leave people with. Considering all we've discussed today about economic growth, inclusivity, and sustainability, what aspect do you think presents the greatest challenge for the world right now? And maybe what one change, however small it might seem, could potentially make a significant difference, something to mull over.
A great question to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Keep that curiosity alive and continue exploring the fascinating and ever-important world of economics on your own.